Purple Space Confident Conversations, hosted by Kate Nash, OBE, with guest Toby Burton, CFO at Fast Markets.
Toby Burton's story is going to blow your mind. He conveys with such clarity that while many of our barriers to career success are caused by external forces, ultimately, we have to dig deep and strengthen our reserves of resilience and confidence to push back against those things. He is currently Chief Financial Officer of Fast Markets. Its annual revenue exceeds 100 million. He began his career at Unilever and became a qualified accountant on their watch. He then found his way to The Economist and sat at the very heart of news, politics and finance, and eventually became CFO for The Economist Group's publishing business, responsible for 300 million of revenues. Toby was born profoundly deaf and has never used speech. He shares a story about being undermined as a 9-year-old boy by one of his teachers. I imagine everyone who has navigated work while living with disability will have experienced a similar moment when maybe a colleague has been blatant in their view that you cannot do something and you reach a crossroads of choice about what you do with that view. Toby decided to prove his teacher wrong, and his career is testament to what you have to do to build inner confidence. His story of flunking a really important board presentation about stock cubes because of not being able to get the right interpreters is a powerful one. Does he blame the lack of interpreters? No. Does he believe his poor performance is not fixable? No. Does he blame his colleagues for not noticing he had interpreters who were unfamiliar to finance? No. As you listen to the film, you will hear his powerful truth that no matter how good your organisation is in relation to its own track record of getting it right, there is no way they will know your own unique adjustment needs. So relying on others to set something up for you is never going to work. He leads. He takes control of his story, his brand, his adjustment needs, his career trajectory. His lessons are powerful, and I learned so much, as I expect you will too. These interviews are brought to you with thanks to remarkable people choosing to share their learning about inner confidence so that others can learn faster. This tranche of 6 conversations in our first series are also brought to you with thanks to LSEG, who are working to create a culture of belonging for everyone, and accessibility is a key part of this. Once you have listened, I ask one thing from you. Send the link to 5 others who you think might be able to pass on the messages to 5 more. We are on a mission at Purple Space to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence, a strong expectation of a positive outcome, and to share practical things that we can do to create and navigate our working world while managing disability and all the things that comes with this. Enjoy our conversation. Toby, tell us why this topic of inner confidence means so much to our audience and the people who are tuning in to our conversation.
Absolutely. For me, inner confidence is such a wonderfully powerful tool, and it really helps you to approach the barriers and the challenges that you might face. And there's a number of different ways that confidence can lead to success, both professionally and personally throughout life. So just thinking about the empowerment that comes from inner confidence, often society has doubts or misconceptions when they look at somebody who's deaf or somebody who has a disability and really lowers their expectations of what that person can achieve. And I think having inner confidence really pushes back against that misconception and brings things into action. I also think it links in with building resilience because, of course, through life there are barriers and challenges and setbacks, and that inner confidence really helps you to build the resilience that you need to continue to face those challenges head on. Inner confidence, also really important for mental health. So I think in those moments where you do have self-doubt and you do have the anxiety or lack of confidence about your ability, you know, there are moments in your life when you need that inner confidence to really enable you to continue to drive forward. I think sometimes it's about self-advocacy as well and building that inner confidence, but also about recognising that everybody has different abilities. So regardless of individual skills, everybody's able to thrive in a number of different environments, which I think is an incredibly powerful thought to hold in your mind.
Wonderful stuff. Toby, I'm so looking forward to our conversation. So let's start. So Purple Space, we're on a mission to build a universal definition of confidence, which for us is a strong expectation of a positive outcome. And what we're doing is we are sourcing inspiration and ideas and stories from individuals who have had extraordinary careers to understand the things that they have learned along the way about building inner confidence. And all of those individuals, very different stories, very different experiences of disability or mental ill health or deafness or neurodiversity. So I want to start with your own career. You have an extraordinary career. You know, you're currently the Group Chief Financial Officer of Fast Markets, a fantastic company. And, you know, I've read some stuff that you've written. I've watched films. You have had an extraordinary career. So anyone who's watching this would be forgiven that you have always been a supremely confident man. So I want to start at the beginning, a little bit of a kind of once upon a time. Maybe you could share some of your story as a child, as a teenager growing up and getting that first job.
Sure, absolutely. So if I think about my career and the success that I've achieved, it has been far from smooth sailing. And there have definitely been issues that I have encountered along the way, which I'm sure we'll get to shortly. But each of those issues that I encountered brought with it learning and really helped me take the next step up the ladder or the next step in my career. So I was born profoundly deaf. I don't use speech and I've never heard well. So I use British Sign Language, which means I rely on interpreters to communicate. Growing up as a deaf person, I attended schools and I attended a mainstream hearing school, which really impacted me entering the hearing world, which is very different. I felt very far behind my peers, and socially the expectations of society had very low expectations of me, didn't expect me to be in any way ambitious. But I wanted to have a really good job. That was always my ambition. I applied for a future leaders programme at Unilever, a £50 billion consumer goods organisation. And it's a programme that develops future leaders, a really tough programme. You join the programme, are expected to keep up. I joined on an IT placement. And in my time there, I set up some new labelling for the pallets within a factory at Unilever in that IT placement. Then I moved to sales, working on a project to do with stock cubes and getting them to market. So I learned about marketing and sales. And then I moved on to a job in finance, which was just so attractive for me, fascinating. I became a qualified accountant in my time at Unilever. And I realised that, you know, the opportunities for careers at Unilever were massive. However, at the same time, I felt like a very small ant in a very large world. So I moved to a much smaller organisation. The Economist, still a global organisation, a politics and news and finance magazine or newspaper. I moved there and became a much bigger fish in a much smaller pond. And the experience that I took from Unilever really became my collateral to build upon the learning. I was able to make change there. I began as a finance analyst at The Economist. I was able to identify opportunities to set up a new finance function, which was called Financial Planning and Analysis, an FP&A function, which I set up in my time there, and it grew. There was a global strategy. We went through really interesting times in the economy. So the Eurozone crisis, the Arab Springs, a number of financial crises in my time there. And I was really sitting at the very heart of a news and politics organisation. I worked my way up to CFO, the Chief Financial Officer, for a big business, one of the divisions within The Economist. I was responsible for a 300 million revenue part of the Economist organisation. And then the opportunity arose for me to move into a very different industry with fast markets. That was quite an interesting proposition to me at the time. So I moved across into a role at Fast Markets. Fast Markets is a B2B organisation, business to business, with a great track record of success, a hugely successful strategy. We provide pricing for commodity markets. It's been on a really successful journey as a business. And last year, we were acquired by a private equity firm, becoming now a private business, which means that my role has moved from being that divisional CFO role into a group CFO role now, currently. So I'm responsible for managing a number of different functions across the organisation with really robust leadership and strong plans in place. It's a very enjoyable role, a very enjoyable place for me to be. So I guess that's a bit of a whistle-stop tour of my career so far.
Wonderful. Huge congratulations, Toby. Really, really extraordinary position. So look, you've nailed it. You've never, ever had to think about how you've built your inner confidence. I'm joking with you. Tell us about those stories, those moments, perhaps when either you've doubted yourself or you've been up close and personal to somebody's doubts. You know, that might be a new manager or a new moment or a new team. Tell us, you know, we work with lots of individuals who are constantly building their inner confidence, particularly when asking for a workplace adjustment. So I wonder what stories you'd like to share about the things that you've done.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does sound, if you look at my CV or you hear that whistle stop tour, as though everything has been smooth sailing. But in every single step along the way, there have been numerous occasions where my confidence was impacted or I struggled. So every success came with it some challenges and barriers. In fact, the first time I ever applied for a job, and I was probably about 17, I applied to one of the big four accounting firms. I very much wanted to work in a financial business as my family had done before me. So I applied to one of the big four. They knew I was deaf. They received my CV and said, oh, thank you very much. We'll keep your CV on our file and we'll get back to you. And I thought they're going to get back to me, but they didn't ever. And my confidence was really impacted by that. Was it because I was deaf? Is that why they never got back to me? Is that why I didn't get the job with them? But I persisted in my attempts and I applied to a Unilever, where my first job was, assuming they would be open-minded, they would know about deaf people. I applied to them. It was a particularly tough entrance interview. I was very proud. I knew I could do it. But I certainly felt as though I was on a journey with no map. There was no role model who had forged the way before me. There was nobody with a disability or a deafness who I could see throughout the organisation. And therefore, there was nobody inspirational above me to look up to and to aspire to be like. Unilever was an organisation that moved incredibly quickly. You couldn't think, you couldn't ask people to hold while you thought and pondered things because I was competing with everybody else. Products needed to be launched and it needed to be our products rather than our competitors that were hitting the shelves in the supermarkets first. And I very much felt like I was in a sink or swim situation at Unilever. I felt very overwhelmed. It was hugely challenging. And I went through a number of different phases in my time there where certainly self-doubt came into play. I wondered if it was the right thing for me. I wondered if that was something I should be aspiring to. You know, my peers were already ahead of me because they could communicate with everybody. So I was on a backwards footing when I even arrived in the door. I had to set up my interpreters, my communication. I had to get people in the same room as me. I had to work twice as hard just to be as good as my peers. And I didn't want to be as good as my peers. I wanted to be better than them because I was hugely ambitious. And certainly self-doubt came into play. I wondered if it was the right thing to do. I was also very reliant on support from a manager. And at the beginning, I thought that was support in that support was in place. But then managers changed along the way and some of those were better than others. Some lacked awareness. And so I had to learn not to rely on other people, but really to be very reliant upon myself and my belief that this was something that I could do, that I could fight my own battles, that I could achieve this success on my own. And in doing that, like I said, every time I had an experience that was perhaps more challenging or that caused me to doubt myself, that did become collateral to use in the next situation where I could enter it with more confidence the next time and the time thereafter and the time thereafter. So each moment became easier than the last. But every time I wished I could go back to that very first step, I could have a role model there who had done it before me, who had forged the way, who had left the map for me to follow, that there were disabled leaders in place, which would have made it so much easier for me without having to forge my own pathway.
Yeah, it's almost as if we have to sometimes become our own role models before we find others. Tell me about the stories you told yourself. What I mean by that is, if you'd had a difficult moment or someone's reacted, you know, awkwardly around you, what do you do to learn from that? How do you go back into that situation?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there were a number of situations where I have met with people who know nothing about deafness or disability.
Yeah.
And I think you just have to accept that in the normal world, in the everyday world, that's what happens. I don't expect excuses. I've learned to stop saying, oh, sorry, I'm deaf. I don't do any of that. I think I've learned that that's not something that's required. I am myself, and I arrive at the table as my own identity. And I think that's much more powerful than approaching that situation with an excuse. It's, you don't arrive in a room and say, well, I'm sorry, I'm a woman. I'm sorry. It's your identity. It's who you're turning up as at the table. And I think that whatever identity you're bringing with you to the table, whether you're Black, you're a woman, it's about showing your identity as yourself. And I think that actually makes other people's lives easier as well, who think, okay, this is just Toby. This is Toby who's turning up at the table. And sometimes I think it's easier just to dive straight into things. I don't do a long explanation of being deaf. And, sometimes I thought in throughout my career, should I email people in advance to let them know I'm deaf so they know there's communication that's arriving? And sometimes I do that. Sometimes it's the right thing to do, and sometimes I don't. And actually, I've got an example of doing that where I'd been having some conversations with a member of staff who was based in New York, some emails back and forward. It was quite an important senior conversation. And when I arrived in New York, I arrived in the office and met this person for the first time. They had no idea I was deaf. They'd never met a deaf person before. And they opened the door, looked at me, realised I was deaf, and just thought, how the hell am I going to communicate? And this person was so unsettled. So I put my laptop on, I plugged my speaker in, put my speaker on the table, started signing. I went straight into business, straight into the meeting. I didn't explain, oh, look, there's an interpreter on my screen and the sound's going to come out of the speaker here and you're going to hear the interpreter's voice. I just went straight into the meeting. And the person probably for the first 5 seconds was hugely discombobulated. Where is the sound coming from? Who's talking? It was a woman's voice. Why is there a woman talking? But after 5 seconds, they pretty much got on the same page. And then we focused on the conversation that we were there to have, had a perfectly good conversation. And I think that was very powerful. And perhaps later on in the evening, that person went back home and said to their partner, oh, this happened to me today. But actually in the moment, I was treated as Toby, just as myself in that room, because I was able to have that conversation with them. I didn't make any excuses. And I think that there's no right or wrong. I think there's a number of different options to try. And sometimes when one of them doesn't work, you try something a little bit different next time. Or if something doesn't work with one person, it doesn't necessarily mean that it doesn't work next time. But the more tools you have in your toolkit, just the more relaxed you know that you can turn up at any situation. You become used to it. You know the different situations you're going to enter. And now, I mean, every time I join a new team at work, I know what it's going to be like. And before, I worried a lot. I really lacked confidence in who sat where. And now, you know, the interpreter sits here. I tell people where people sit. And I think everybody knows that their life is made easier by that as well. I know what needs to be done. It doesn't really need a conversation or a discussion in advance.
Wonderful stories. And the way you describe them, Toby, it's so clear that you're using all of yourself to build a very positive and purposeful brand as a senior C-suite leader. It actually becomes part of your brand. It's really interesting. Are there things that you've learned that really don't work that you'd never do again? You know, if you look back at the younger Toby joining Unilever and, you know, are there things that you've done that you just never do again?
Absolutely. Many.
How long have you
many,
got?
Many, many. Yes, I have got plenty of examples. Often things fell apart and there were times when I thought I was done. That was it. I'd ruined everything. And I realise now that those moments built my resilience because those things just didn't work. But there were other ways around them that would have worked better or that do work better. One thing that I learned fairly early on is that relying on other people was not going to be the way for me. I needed to take control. I needed to be in control of things.
How do you mean, Toby? Do you mean interpreters or do you mean line managers or direct reports? When you say not relying, who is it you mean?
I think not relying on companies to know how to work things out for me. Let me give you an example that comes to mind. So there was an example where I was told there was a hugely important meeting next week, a steering committee where decisions had to be made on this day. There were lots of people who were going to be in the room at the same time. And, you know, I was ambitious. I wanted to be at the table with everybody else. At no point did I say, oh, I'm not sure that's going to be possible for me. So I said, absolutely, I will be there. And then I needed to find interpreters. I didn't have an interpreter book for that day. And I looked far and wide. And on that particular day, I couldn't find an interpreter. The day before, the evening before, I searched far and wide. Really close to the date, I found a couple of interpreters. I booked them. I confirmed them. I sent them the hours. I told them the meeting was really important. I briefed them. I prepped them. I sent them documentation. I walked them through it. I explained what I wanted to achieve from the meeting. I made sure they both knew exactly what the meeting was all about and how important it was. The night before the meeting happened, one of the organisers sent out an email saying, oh, actually, someone's ill. We'll do the meeting another time. And I thought, poor, just it impacted my confidence so much. I had put so much effort, blood, sweat and tears into searching, finding interpreters. And then the meeting was just moved, just like that. And I realised that, you know, I couldn't blame them for doing that because I knew how much work I had put into that. And I think what I learned from that was that I spoke to people about that and said, you know, if it's a really important meeting, that's great. And I absolutely want to be there. I will make sure I find the absolute best interpreters. I will find when they're available and I will book them. And then you will know that I have got the interpreters booked. If they're important meetings, you know, I'm here, I'm ready to come. I want really good interpreters. So we align everything, make sure the interpreters are booked. And then I leave it to the organisers to brief the interpreters. And if they move the meeting, then they would rearrange the interpreters. That no longer becomes, you know, my sweat that goes into that and my effort, because actually it's their responsibility to find those interpreters and have them available at the right time. So I feel like I just have been able to take much more control of that sort of organisation of things.
Yeah, great story. Great story, Toby. I want to tuck into some of the learns that you've experienced by networking with us, others. You know, you are a very networked individual. You know, you obviously well known in the deaf community, but beyond that too, you think about employee networks. I know you have a lot of experience of, you know, helping to galvanize networks. What would you say is the value of networking, talking to, learning experiences from other people who are either deaf or have disability? What is it that we get from each other, but that perhaps we don't get from others?
Absolutely. And I mentioned before that the beginning of my career was tough because I had no role models. I didn't have those people around me. And that was a real struggle. I desperately wanted people to look up to. Halfway through my career, I realised I very much wanted to give that back to the deaf community. I wanted to be that person. So I became a trustee of the Royal Association for Deaf People, which is the oldest charity in the UK supporting the deaf community. And I ultimately became the chair of their board of trustees. And I realised in my time there that people who were deaf and probably people with other disabilities as well, the challenges that were faced was that it can be quite kind of insular and quite focused. And in order to move up, you really need to kind of pull everybody else up with you. You need to use that power to help everybody around you and uplift everybody and really give back. And I think there was a real opportunity in those roles to give back. And, you know, I definitely wouldn't describe myself as a super hot networker. It's not my area of skill. I have got good networks, but it's not something that comes really naturally to me. It takes quite a lot of effort. I don't enter a room, ready to network with everybody. You know, I've got an interpreter stood by my side. I know there's barriers. People don't have any deaf awareness. They don't understand. So it takes a lot of effort for me to network. It's not really easy, but it's absolutely worthwhile. I think that those networks can introduce you to their networks and their networks thereafter. And I think that if I look back, there have probably been 3 or 4 people throughout my career who have made significant impacts on my success. They've really unlocked the barriers, or they have opened doors for me, which I could have done myself, but they've just used their keys and unlocked them and really made life much easier for me through those networks. People who I keep in touch with to this day, but people who really were advocates. They believed in me. They knew that I had potential, maybe untapped potential that they hadn't yet seen come to fruition. And I think it's about finding those people, finding the right people who can create the right conversations and who can travel with you on the journey. And I very much want to give back to the deaf community in similar roles. In fact, I started mentoring some deaf professionals who were in similar positions to where I was 20 years ago, who were lacking confidence, who were encountering issues with their managers, struggling to communicate. And I have mentored people who are on that similar pathway. What's quite interesting, actually, I had one person who came to meet with me, hugely ambitious, worked at a bank, wanted to do really well. We spent some time together in a mentoring relationship. And then I haven't seen them for the last 10 years. And all of a sudden, in my work at Fast Markets, we have a big banking facility that's in place with a big lender. And I'm going to a presentation, a management presentation to the lenders to tell them how our organization's doing. And on that list of attendees is that same person that I mentored 10 years ago. And he's worked his way up. He's working at this investment bank in a really successful career. And that just had such a powerful impact on me about how that network, that mentoring, how people who are deaf and disabled should be helping each other to really find those opportunities to lift each other up and bring other people on the journey with you. You know, pulling other people down doesn't make you any higher. You bring the people up around you and you share those tips and the successes, you find them and encounter them along your way. And that builds confidence. And often the barriers that we face, they don't need to be repeated again. Really, the best way is to learn from other people. You encountered that barrier. How did you get around it? Well, okay, then I'm going to get around it from the start. That gives me the confidence to know that I can do that. And if everybody shared one of those tips with each other, it becomes such a powerful resource.
Oh, I love it. I really love it, Toby. You know, we at Purple Space, we hold store in the power, the technique of storytelling. You know, storytelling, we believe, like Brené Brown, is really data with a soul. And for you and I, our disability, our experiences of deafness, it's altogether obvious. You know, we can't step into a room without others knowing. For me, arthritis. For you, you are deaf. But of course, there are many C-suite leaders who have a choice as to whether to share their experience of disability. And it's often the unseen or hidden. It might be mental ill health. It may be neurodivergence. So what would you say to those individuals who may be struggling with that choice to share or not to share? You know, what in your view has been and continues to be the power in sharing stories of disability that will help those that come behind us?
And lots of deaf people say to me, should I let an employer know that I'm deaf before an interview? Should I put it somewhere on my CV? Should I make it obvious that I'm deaf, or do I keep it off the CV and nobody knows? And if you remember my story back to my first job application where I was rejected because I was deaf, I think. I mean, it was very clear. I believe that's probably why I didn't get the job and the impact that had upon my confidence. I mean, I think that there's not one solution. I think that there are options to try. But what I have noticed through my working life is that those who are able to tell their stories and be open have more of a chance of being recognised, I think, as a person who can unlock opportunities. And I think, you know, if people don't see who you are, they often don't see the barriers that you're encountering. And I think I've always been quite direct about the experiences that I have been through and what that means for me. You know, I think that I have a responsibility to share the way that I have encountered those barriers and the hard work that it took. I think that's a shared responsibility. And working together with people is something that just becomes easier if everything's out in the open and everybody knows. I think as well, one thing that sticks in my mind from a long time ago is, you know, I would kind of enter a room and be quite shy to ask for help and not be sure how to approach the topic or what the right way was to ask. And that almost formed barriers of its own. And I think that what I learned was that asking for help really opens up a whole realm of opportunities that might not otherwise be there.
Yeah, powerful piece of advice. Toby, you know, we're creating a purple space, the assets, the collateral, publications, the know-how that will support people to build that inner confidence. And we talk about the six fundamentals, the building blocks of building inner confidence, and the six hurdles. Now, I know you've seen those materials. Which of those really spoke to you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, when I read through those materials, I thought they were so incredibly powerful. And I wish that they were available when I started my career those 20 years ago. So much information that I think absolutely spot on. That's exactly what would have helped me in the early days of my career. And, you know, some of it's common sense, some of it isn't world changing. It's not brand new, but it's absolutely right. It's, you know, really spot on advice. And I think also thinking about using that material as tools. And when I looked at the fundamentals, one of the building blocks that really spoke to me was about, you know, taking control. So, you know, arriving in a new job or a new team and saying, this is me. These are the things that I need. These are the adjustments I need. You know, not relying on other people, because wherever you arrive and however great that company is, however disability friendly they are, they've ticked all of their boxes, they've got all of their certificates and they're very proud of it. They've never worked with you before, but they don't know exactly what your needs are. And disability comes in such a variety. Everybody is so different. You know, in the deaf community, there are a number of different types of deafness. There's people like me. I don't use my voice. I use sign language. There are people who use hearing aids, cochlear implant. They use their own voices. It's such a plethora of deaf people. There's no way that your company, however good they are, can know what your needs are. So I think relying on them to set something up that may or may not suit you was never the way forward for me. I think me being in control was the way forward. Whenever I start a new job or join a new team, I bring in a deaf awareness trainer in my first week there so that my colleagues, my peers, my managers can learn about deaf awareness. And after that, I've always noticed such a change in people's attitudes just from that small piece of education. And it almost feels like a shortcut to breaking through some of those barriers rather than playing a long game, people not understanding me, encountering lots of problems and taking learnings. Actually, just getting things set up from the start has been incredibly helpful. And now I feel like I've got that. It's a playbook. It's something I follow. When I join a new team, I will do exactly the same things that I did before. You know, the things that I learned work well, I will implement again. And I know what works for me. You know, often people don't know how to work with interpreters. And in fact, interpreters who are new in my workplace don't know the jargon. It's a very jargonistic environment I work in. So I have, again, a playbook. It shows the names of the people, the hierarchy, who I work with, the jargon that we're using so that voiceovers can interpret smoothly. I give them tips. I give them advice. I brief them when they arrive at my workplace. And that does just help things to run much more smoothly. And then thinking about the hurdles that you mentioned as well, you know, those hurdles that you encounter and how you overcome them. one of the hurdles that I saw that I thought was particularly relevant and something that I would really hold quite closely in my mind was about, you know, not blaming other people for the things that went wrong or the mistakes that were made or the lack of confidence. And it's so easy to do that and very tempting to, because life can be frustrating. It can be incredibly annoying to be a person with a disability or with deafness who is struggling their way through. And I remember you know, when I was my younger self, I was 25, hugely ambitious, wanted a great job, wanted to be in that really professional working environment. And I was in a new product team, very innovative, creating new products all of the time. They were working on the Nord Stock Cube. So it was a new product to market that was going to go out to supermarkets. I was really excited. It was a team that was hugely creative, full of a buzz of creativity. And I needed to create a business case for that newly innovated product. So I needed to work on a business case as to how we were going to release that product to market. So I'd worked with the team, and the only thing left to do was to present to the board for them to sign the business case off, and then the product would be released into the market. Everything else was in place. I was well prepared. I was really confident that everything was exactly where it should be. I booked interpreters. My favourite regular interpreters weren't available, so I found two interpreters I didn't know so well. I stood up at the front of the room full of confidence. I can do this. My presentation is amazing. I knew my business case inside out. I was hugely passionate about it. I stood up, I started to sign. And 5 minutes later, I looked around the room and there were furrowed brows. The board didn't look convinced. I looked at the interpreters and they were obviously struggling. They were struggling to voice over. They were veering off track. What they were saying wasn't really relevant to what I was saying. They were just struggling so much to understand what I was signing. And then, you know, my business case looked like a loser. I mean, it just didn't look good at all. And my confidence was impacted so terribly. I wished I could fall down a hole and not come back out again. And I thought, you know, I can't work in a place like this. There's barriers everywhere. It's such hard work. The interpreter did a terrible job. The board didn't understand me. And I could have blamed everybody. Everybody else in the room I could have blamed. I was so frustrated and I was so cross. I had failed. You know, I was so hard on myself. It was such a failure. I went home and I procrastinated and I thought about it and I thought about it. And then I thought about it and thought, why am I blaming everybody else? Why was I so reliant on everybody else in that room? This is something I need to take responsibility for myself. So the next day, I sent a message and said, I realised that didn't go well. Can we do it again? I said to the board, because I'm absolutely confident I have the business case exactly where I should be. I said, can I give you a date? So I'm going to check when my interpreters are available, interpreters who understand me, who work well with me, and we will book the meeting again. So the meeting was set up. I stood up at the front of the room and it was like music to their ears. It was a totally different story. It landed beautifully. The board were excited. They saw how attractive the project was and they said, yes, let's go. They knew it was going to be a success. And it was just such a different situation. And it changed my attitude so much. You know, I could have blamed the interpreters or I could have blamed the board, but there was really no point in doing so. I needed to take control of my own destiny. And I think that was a real learning that I took, and really gave me confidence to take control of situations.
Oh, wow. Extreme ownership. Extreme ownership. You know, we know that there are so many challenges in our life, and it could be this and it could be that, and others haven't done this and others haven't done that. But being able to take an experience and own it and then do it differently, really powerful. Who knew that a stock cube had a story like that behind it? I'm going to cook very differently from now on. I'm going to use stock cubes in everything, including omelets. Toby, really powerful. So as we start to move towards the end, and I could go on forever here, we have a tradition where we ask you a question that's been posed by one of the previous interviewees. And this question is about pity. So it's something that I've written a lot about, you know, my last book, Positively Purple. I touch on this. So pity is one of the most corrosive of human emotions. And if somebody hates me, I can do something about that. You can have a bit of a conversation if somebody really dislikes you. But pity has an undercurrent. You know, by stealth, it comes at you from a slightly different place. Now, you are a very, you know, you have a very strong brand, a very powerful brand, Toby. But I would expect even you have, from time to time, experienced that notion of pity or a sense from others that there's a sadness attached to your life by being deaf. Now, I may be wrong, so I'm testing it. It's a bit of a hunch, it's a hypothesis. But how do you react to pity or the soft bigotry of low expectation? What do you do in the face of that?
I would say that throughout my life, I certainly have encountered incidents, especially as a child or as I was growing up, where I was treated differently to other people. And that moment of, you know, I think as soon as you are deaf, you are treated as somebody who is lesser, who has lower expectations placed upon you. As a child, I had teachers who looked at me. In fact, a teacher of the deaf who treated the deaf students as, oh, you're deaf, you know, what are you going to do in your future career? You probably don't have particularly high aspirations. And in fact, I remember as a nine-year-old child being in a class talking about future careers. And we all had a book with pictures in of a number of different careers. And, you know, I was flicking through the book. And I thought, oh, I want to do something a bit different. All of my deaf peers had picked a career and they said what they wanted to be. And I said, I want to be this one. I want to be a journalist. And I said to my teacher, this is what I want to be. And my teacher said, oh, well, how could you be a journalist? They said, you can't make phone calls. You need to be able to hear to make phone calls. Or it's a bit of a wasted dream, isn't it? You would never be able to be a journalist, that teacher said to me. And I thought, what? I was 9 years old and my teacher had already taken away, you know, that dream from me, just as if they had popped a balloon and it was gone. They had let all of the air out of my dream. There was no encouragement. There was no expectation that I could achieve. And I remember my 9 year old self saying back to that teacher, I will become a journalist. And when I do, I will come back to you and I will show you that you were wrong. I will. And I will show you. So as I travelled through my life, I never did become a journalist, but I was a CFO for a huge journalistic establishment, one of the biggest in the world, with a very well-known brand. And when I look back to my nine-year-old self, that pity, that sympathy, that lack of expectation was terrible. But I decided that wouldn't impact my confidence. And if anything, it gave me an opportunity to build resilience. It gave me the feeling of power to challenge back against that pity and to prove it wrong and to try to change that mindset. And I guess what I took from that was not, it wasn't something that I believed in. It really just gave me an opportunity to prove that teacher wrong and to prove that absolutely I could become what I wanted to be.
Have you dropped her a note?
Yes. Oh, in fact, I met them. I met the teacher. So there was a school reunion, an annual reunion. And I went to that school reunion. I met that teacher and I said, do you remember that conversation? Do you remember when you said you can't? And it was a great day, a great day in my life. I felt incredibly proud to have that conversation because, you know, deaf people can unlock those opportunities. Nobody should stop dreaming. Deaf people can do anything they want to do. And, you know, there are absolutely ways to achieve your dreams, whatever they might be. And certainly something that I try to advocate for deaf people in their workplace or their personal lives to really be aiming for whatever they want to achieve.
A wonderful close to our conversation. Toby, I could stay here all day, all night, into the following week. We thank you warmly for your incredible insights. And I know that this will have such resonance to everybody listening and watching. A warm thanks to you. So the tradition is that you will write a question to the next interviewee. For the moment, we thank you.
Oh, very good. Thank you.
Thank you for your story.
It was an absolute pleasure to share it with you. Thank you so much.
Purple Space is on a mission to cascade a universal definition of inner confidence for employees with disabilities. Our organisation members can access a growing suite of learning tools in order to navigate our working worlds while managing disability, deafness, mental health and neurodivergence. Notice the fundamentals. Remember the hurdles. Take individual action. For more information, visit our website www.purplespace.org.